Hi guys, welcome to Mothcast. This is the second installment, episode, rambling, whatever you want to call it. Luke is back.
Where did I go? Didn't realise I went anywhere.
Well, it's been a while. It's been 5 weeks. We've probably been like, 5 weeks as we record this since the last show. We wanted to sort of do them every... The aim is to do them once every month, so we're a bit behind on that. Where you've gone, Luca, is out in the shed because you're putting a new boat together.
Yes. Got my new Prowler. Well, actually, it's now called the Zero, which arrived about 2 weeks ago. It's all looking good. Just got a prototype sail from AMEC today it's a loan sail to use. And I'm just doing the tweaking at the moment. It's going quite well. I think it's going to be a lot quicker than the old boat just because we've developed a couple of things. But, you know, having said that, at the moment, it's still probably just a touch slower than the old one. But it's, I feel pretty confident. I think it's going to be really good.
So come on, spill the beans. What's new?
Lots of support from CSD. So I got my nice high modulus tubes. I've got new wing bars, which are smaller diameter. High modulus ellipticals at the front, compressor struts. I've got... tweaks to the rudder. I've got a control rod that's been changed. We've got rid of the cable. We've got a pusher coming in through the foredeck now.
Finally,
yeah, and definitely an improvement. And also, you know, the mast is different. The boom is different. The different stiffnesses to what some other people are running. You know, I'm running 24-1 on my Veng. Little tweaks everywhere. Hopefully the end result is a big gain for little tweaks. So,
if only your old boat wasn't going so fast.
The old boat's pretty quick. The old boat, I think, is probably one of the quickest prowlers around. It was very light and it was set up very well. And, you know, when I sold it, it came with a brand new centerboard, which was a little bit better than the old one as well. So it's a good boat. But, you know, I try to improve the new one as well. And, yeah, you know, fingers crossed it'll be good, and, you know, lots of new products on the market right now, so it has to compete with that.
But at least we still have one advantage, because we know with Grant, he can only jibe one way. Zoolander!
Yeah, that's right, you gotta sail it.
Because he's bad hit. So, the Mark II hasn't hit the light of day yet. Lots of nothing about the Mark II, so a big flurry of posts and then crickets.
Yeah, it's the marketing strategy, you know. Build up the suspense before the product comes, and I think it's working for them quite well at the moment. As long as they don't do it for too long, because then you start to piss people off because you're not really giving them any information. But I think so far they're working quite well, and I'm sure lots of work's being done overseas with that.
Well, we have spies everywhere. Heard a few rumours, whether they're true or not, random to see. Heard the website's close, but not quite there. Heard that the centerboard case might be moving forward a little bit compared to the other boats. Also heard that the foils aren't going to fit a standard Blade Rider or Prowler, so there's two sets that you get if you want to order the foils, so there's obviously some magic tweaky connection system that's potentially going to come along there. What else do we know? I'm expecting we'll see the standard AMAC or Brokeback wand on the boat. The new renders look pretty sexy, something a bit special up the front there, so...
Yeah, it just looks tidy, you know? They've cleaned up the area that's always been vulnerable to breakages, you know. Carly broke my push rod one when I was at the Nationals.
She almost broke
about 2 hours before the start. So, you know, if it's all enclosed, you can't really break it, which is good. And also you can, you know, hide your gearings and all your setup because it's under a nice little cover. So quite a nifty little idea. I'm sure the other ones will catch on with that. But as far as performance advantage over that, I can't see it really.
And speaking of all things AMAC, looks like North Sails are gunning after him, trying to get into the sail market.
Very interesting. They've got three models at the moment, ranging from, you know, about $1,400 Australian for the monofilm one to about $2,500 Australian for the Cuban fibre one, which...
twice as much. Will it be twice as good?
Well, you know, Cuban fibre is a bit expensive, so I can understand that, but surely it's not $1,000 more than the standard monofilm, and it's just a marketing thing, really.
Yeah, the other thing interesting to note is they've gone for lighter fibres. So, personally, being the one sale every 2 years club guy, that's definitely not something that you'd see me doing, going for a lighter sale that's going to last even a shorter period of time, but I'm sure there'll be a couple of guys at the front that'll happily burn, get their dollar notes and light them, and get, as long as they've got the latest and greatest, thinnest, lightest saber kilo, spend $2,500.
Yeah, that's right. I still think that, you know, the sales are pretty good. I think they're along very similar lines of the KA sales, and quite clearly they've used that as a benchmark. I think if they're lucky, they'll get the shape to be as good as an MSL, or current MSL sale. Amex been doing it for a long time, so these guys are just catching up at this stage. But having said that, I don't see a reason why they can't produce as quick a sale with development time ticking over. And, you know, it's not a bad thing to have another manufacturer in the market as well.
Yeah, competition is always good.
Mm.
Our guest from last week, Mr. Scott Babbage, has obviously been quiet and hiding and not stirring controversy at all online, as per usual.
Yeah, right. He's had a quite a controversial comment about the St. George Mothi is boycotting the SIRS Sydney International Regatta. Which I found quite insulting, to be honest. I thought it was pretty harsh, and considering that we did a fair bit for club racing in Sydney, and a couple of other people, you know, got on the bandwagon and sort of supported those comments, and I think he's just really generating interest in his website through something that's not quite true. It's, I don't really dig it. I was a little bit pissed off about it.
I think there's some people that know. If you know Scott and you know that's thought that he guns for the controversial posts.
I don't think it's coming from his heart. I think it's just about creating controversy. And, you know, I like Scott. He's a good bloke.
Yeah, I think
he didn't like the comments.
Yeah, I think he's just trying to have a bit of a laugh, and a few people don't get where Scott comes from and have just taken it the wrong way.
Yeah.
So it's a bit of a shame. Speaking of SIRS, looks like Bora the Explorer is coming down under for Christmas.
Mm, should be interesting. I've invited him down to St. George to sail with us. I think it'll be good.
Yeah, I think it'll be good to see him down. I can see he's already trying to find out who the fastest guy in the country is so he can try and knock them on the head. And
I wonder who the fastest guy is. It's got to be the world champion, doesn't it?
Well, is it? That's the million-dollar question. Who will find out? I would expect to see every second of every sailing the Bora does down under in a feature-length movie now that he's got, 28 different video cameras on order that he's bringing with you.
Yeah, it's good. We'll get some good footage. Ah, it's excellent. Why not? Four cameras on the boat. Bring it on.
So you can see people sailing past him in front of him. All right, I think that's enough for our rambling intro. This week's guest is Phil Stevenson. We sat down and Phil's the original guy we sat down to with this crazy idea of doing a podcast. So about a couple of months back, we actually recorded this. We sit down and we talk through Phil's history of some of the crazy mad scientist things that he tried on his way to building his own boats and building chainsaw. So
yeah, he's an interesting guy. You know, he's done a fair bit of work with the foils. He's built so many boats, not only Moths, you know, 12s and NS14s and all that sort of stuff. So he's an interesting guy that has a lot to offer as far as ideas go, and he's done and tried a lot of things, but a lot of people are actually speculating on the internet what might work, what may not work. He's actually gone and done it, and he's got some proof what works, what doesn't work. He's right. Not the front of the fleet at the moment, but he's an interesting bloke anyway with some good ideas.
So here's the chat we had with Phil.
What I wanted to talk about, Phil, you have had some fun, for want of a better word, designing and building foils pretty much since 2003?
About 2003, when Rowan showed us at the Nationals that it can be going really fast, Andrew and I started experimenting, and first off with the first version of Chainsaw, we tried a couple of pretty weird ideas and continued on with several other weird ideas until we eventually got around to following everybody else.
I don't think you've ever been accused of following the norm.
No, not following
the norm now. You are now. So with Chainsaw 2003, well, tell us, what did you start with? What was the configuration?
When I said before there was no one in Sydney experimenting, I was wrong there in that Ian Ward had done some work beforehand, but was really very infrequent in his experiments, and we had some meetings with him, and he was influenced by the sailboard guy in California that was sailing around with a canard on the front of his sailboard and a mainsail on the rear, and he was trying to get a bow canard working that would provide the stability and pitch control and would have the main lift further aft. So my first attempt had a rudder on the bow, under the bow, with a foil on it, a small foil, a large foil on the centreboard, and initially no rudder on the back. And we sailed that one day at Balmoral and spent most of our time going backwards, because once you get to try and tack it and get to high angles of attack, the forward rudder stalled and provided heaps of drag, which gave you instant huge weather helm, and the boat went backwards faster than it would go forward for a long time. No automatic pitch control or height control, so it crashed frequently. We gave up after a while.
How did it perform in a straight line when it had some
flat water, steady wind?
It sailed. I don't know how fast it was, because there was no other boats happened to line up whenever we got it going. But we spent most of the time trying to get it going and a little bit of the time with it actually moving. So we went ashore and put the conventional rudder on the back and sailed it, and it was a little bit better. But then the rope linkage between the rudders was a bit of a hassle, and they weren't always aligned properly. So it did some weird things when there were three foils in the water and only two of them lined up.
A rope linkage must have been interesting.
Yeah. A few years later, I tried a cable linkage and it wasn't much better.
How did the linkage system work? Was it like essentially a T of the tiller with...
It was a bell crank front and back, and the lines went through some small ball-bearing blocks and crossed in the middle somewhere, and so that the rudder went in opposite directions. Because if they went in the same direction, that would only go sideways, not round in a circle.
So nice try, but that didn't work. What was the next logical step did you see from that?
We
point?
Then tried, before the Worlds in Melbourne, we both built handmade foils, carved timber or balsa foil, and tried to make what we thought John Islett was making.
Sorry, so when you say you're both talking...
Andrew and I. At this stage, up until 2006 or 7, Andrew was participating in all this until he went off and sailed 12-footers for 4 years. And he's back again now downstairs making himself some new foils.
We can hear sanding as we speak, which is always good in a moth household. At this stage, you've still got no trailing edge wands, no flaps.
After the bow rudder got cast aside, I went back to it. An aft rudder and a big foil on the back, and tried a trailing edge wand on both the rudder and the centreboard. It didn't seem to behave. I didn't refine it very well, probably. The linkages didn't work very well. There was no spring loading in any direction. It relied on the weight of the wand falling on the water, and the wake from the foil tended not to let it foil on the water, like wake from the vertical. So it didn't do what it was meant to do. And the boat just did weird things.
Something very different to what we're running these days.
Yeah.
What sort of foil sections?
Just hand-carved wooden foils based on background knowledge of aerofoils from aeroplanes. Nothing very scientific. We were trying to get the systems to work first.
From the photos that I've seen on... which I've seen online, which I'll post up on the website, I can see you've got some slight dihedral
in
foils. What were the thoughts behind that?
Well, the idea of dihedral is that when you have slight leeway, you end up with a righting moment, a positive righting moment. For instance, if an aeroplane has dihedral, when you yaw it with the rudder, the wing which goes forward ends up with a slightly higher angle of attack, and so it turns to the right. So your right rudder yaws the plane right, the left wing gets more lift, it turns to the right. In the boat, in the sense of the boat, the idea is that the leeward foil, due to the leeway, has a slightly higher angle of attack than the windward foil, so it provides righting moment against the wind, which should give you more power in theory. Very subtle, I think.
I'm listening that doesn't know, dihedral is the wings being raked higher at the tips than they are in the centre when viewed from front on. What width were these foils? Were they...
Had up to 1.2 metres.
So significantly larger than we're running at the moment.
Yeah. But about this time, we'd been communicating a little bit with John Islett, and he offered to sell me some blanks that he had left over from one of his earlier experiments. And so for $50 or something, he posted over some old foil sections, distract parallel sections. They had a small spar in them, which wasn't anywhere near like he puts in normal stuff, but they were sufficient for us, for Andrew and I, to use one each for a main boil on one of our centreboards, and that got us going a little better. We had, basically every time we went sailing, we broke it off the centreboard because John didn't sell us the tees, but, and also because the spar in them wasn't put in it for that purpose. It was, these sections came from another idea that they had that weren't ever used in that sense before. But that got a start.
Hi, Bruce here. Mothcast would not be possible without support from our sponsors. Fullview is a boutique design studio that fuses creativity with strategy to create effective graphic design for web and print. To find out more about their work and services, go to www.ful-vue.com.
What was going on in the rest of the world at that point in time? Where was, what were John, Ireland, Rowan, where were they up to with their development cycle?
I think the principles, the basic setup was similar. Rowan was refining the technique on how to do it. And in the process, the two of them were refining the systems on control, particularly the main controls, the wand and the flap size and the mechanism. And they were just refining things, making things better. There were subtle changes to the size of the foils. This stage, there were still the square-tip foils, and you still had the flap on the rudder. And that was up to the worlds in Melbourne. In Melbourne, neither Andrew broke gear on the first day and didn't put his foils on again. Mine didn't work at all, and I sailed around a few times with the mine and went slowly and all crashed and basically sailed with a hull in the water most of the time.
So, Luca, you were sailing at Blackrock at the time. Was that almost like a turning point, really, for the class in Australia, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think it was. It was the first 7-8 boats had foils, and it was pretty clear that you just cannot do well if you don't have it. I sort of believe that, oh, you know, if it's a really heavy regatta, we'll have a chance. If it's a light regatta, I could do a rapid non-foiling boats. And Les won the Nationals a week before the World Championships low riding as well, which should be noted. But regardless, I think if the foils, if the conditions are within the normal sort of Australian summer, there's just no way you can compete without foiling. So it definitely was a turning point where I think everybody realised that we'd better get them soon and catch up to these guys that have been sailing for the last 2 years on foils, and now we're all just over 2 years behind.
Another turning point for me at Black Rock was the generosity of John Islett in telling us how he did things, and that was fantastic to me, someone who had something so unique in the world to be able to share it willingly to other people. I thought was fantastic.
John really, I suppose, was the pioneer. He's, you know, yeah. Like, Ian, obviously Ian Ward had tried a lot of stuff, but in regards to actually making a really competitive, strong package, I think John really came and blew everyone away at that point.
I liked John as a person when I first met him. He was sort of, I don't know, I think I just get along well with people to actually sit down and work out ways of making stuff. And he was one of them. And I used to like Thorpe's company for the same reason. But he was generous enough to tell me a lot of things. And I mentioned before the T-joint. That was the one thing he smiled at me and says, no, I've got to keep some secrets. And I think he still likes to keep that a secret.
That is a secret. And I think I know of three people that probably have seen inside one of John's foils, and two of those is because they probably blew their foils apart in the process.
Yeah. I've seen one broken too, but I still don't know. I know what it basically looks like, but I don't know what's actually in it, what's fibre content, all that sort of thing. I think it's probably something pretty special.
So, at the time, Phil, what were you using for your foil?
I had several horizontal main foils, one of which was the horizontal John had sold me earlier. We had continual problems with the T-joints, and at that point we had removable slippers that were sort of a centreboard with a squarish end and a slipper that went over that, and the foil was bonded to that slipper. And this was as much for transport and storage as it was for anything else, but it also meant that when we cracked one, we could slip that one off and put another one on that we had a spare. Didn't have to have a complete set.
Probably the precursor to the whole blade rider separate, you know, horizontal and vertical.
No, it wasn't. It was another example of doing the same thing, a different method of doing the same thing. Ours were a little fat and draggy, but it didn't have the torpedo. It was just a fat T. And the main problem we had is we were bonding things to the top skin, and we didn't have anything much internal to bond the T through to the bottom skin. It was made up as a foil with a spar, and then we bonded the T on rather than building the T in.
this may be a trade secret, as T-joints are a little bit mystical, but what sort of structure are you putting inside your T-joints
now, and where you adapt? The last two we've made, we went through a period, before that, we went through a period of bonding in large lumps of stainless steel, bent into two L's and a flat and glued in. Heavy, not particularly stiff, but if you happen to bend them, you can straighten them again. And that got us through a lot of racing. Even if we had a bad crash and bent it, we could continue sailing and fix it later. Now we're laminating up things like, somewhat like John's doing, maybe what like John's doing, but the end product looks a bit like what he's got. How we laminate them up is probably a bit more basic, and whether we use anything like the material he uses in terms of fibre or resin, I doubt. The last one survived a crash into the sandbank at St George near the end of last season and came up unscathed, so I think we might have it right.
We've talked about the foils, but what were you bolting them onto?
The boat or the centerboard?
The boat, really.
Chainsaw went through a couple of iterations. The first version of Chainsaw, so I sailed at Malang and at Catharabar, and at Catharabar the chine split. The chine, this was a plywood sides and bottom of carbon fibre laminate chines, and the chine split, the boat broke. So it came home, got patched up roughly, and was used in the first half a season of experiment. Following year, I scrapped that hull completely and built a narrower, still a full-length chine hull, but stretched ply, so it was curved panels, and low freeboard. The idea of low freeboard was you didn't need freeboard if you're going to fly in the air when there were waves. Unfortunately, the boat didn't fly very well, so I spent a lot of time with water over the deck. But the hull was good, end of its life, before I bought Hungry Tiger anyway. It won a couple of races, won the last heat of the States at Tanilba, and then St George final race that season in very light wind, and so the hull must be okay. And that chainsaw got, that stage, pulled apart, deck taken off, sat in the shed for 18 months to dry out, and got resurrected later on for further experiments, which we'll make until later.
You've become quite famous in the past with the stress build ply hulls. Can you just talk us through?
The stress ply as a method originated in England with John Pasaglia building the Unicorn A-class about 1964.
Yeah.
When we heard about it, my dad and I thought that's a good way to build a boat. And I had a double chine A-class at the time that I'd won a lot of races with, and someone was going to buy it. So before we sold it, we turned it upside down on the front lawn and measured all the girths.
Mm.
And then we went to the shed in a week or two and cut up a piece of 1.5 mil plywood and built a quarter scale model based on those girths, and then worked out how we're going to put it together. From the Unicorn, we got the idea. From Harmony, we got the offsets. And we built the boat, and that became Rhapsody, which was my father's Champion A class for about the next 10 years, and there are about 50 of them built in Australia. While he was doing that, I took up sailing 12 footers and built several, I think 5 12 foot skiffs out of stress ply, and worked out how to turn a centre seam, single seam catamaran shape into a skiff shape by having a centre seam and chines, and then forgot about it for about 15 years. Until Andrew got to the stage of, he was about 15 years old and decided he might like to sail moths. And so we dragged out the ideas and started making relatively cheap moth hulls, starting with the wide anachronism. Then we made his bent and twisted, and I made Paper Tiger and Anyone Can Be Immature, and then the chainsaw, the last second chainsaw. And they were all the stress ply boats. And then culminating with the canoe a couple of years ago, 3 years ago.
So how much does it cost in comparison with the materials?
About a quarter.
Yeah.
But the moth, the hull of a moth is only maybe 10 or 15% of the total cost of the whole moth. So you don't really save a lot of money. The next Stevo moth will probably have the basic shape of bent and twisted, but not bent or twisted. And but we'll use that for a mould and make a foam or Nomex carbon skin over the outside of it.
So you must be quite happy with the hull shape coming out of the plug as well, to use that as a plug.
I think that hull shape, which used to be exceptionally fast in light weather, might be very good for a foil boat because it'll only be in the water in light weather.
I suppose the question, do hulls matter? You've got a couple of different ideas out there. You've got the Blade Rider, which is quite flat in the back, the idea in keeping volume in the stern so that it can tack. You've now got the new Velociraptor, which is a V-shape. You know, who's got it right, in your opinion?
I'm not sure either of them are right. I think the straight, narrow shape or the V-shape are meant to go good in a straight line, which isn't much good for tacking. The volume in the back, I think, is a leftover from when, before we put incidents in the main foils, and the boats used to take off with the stern dragging. That's not on anymore. The boats take off level. The boats take off at a speed much lower than the hull would plane anyway. I don't think the hull supports a hell of a lot of weight at takeoff. I'm more interested in reducing the drag in the weather, which is too light for you to foil. And that's a different strength, wind strength for a lot of different people, depending on how heavy you are. So the bigger your person, the more important it is to reduce drag in that light stuff, because you're going to spend more time in winds where it's not strong enough for you to foil than the light people.
Why are you looking at me?
I'm looking at you and looking at me.
So are you talking about a rounded hull, similar to what Marty Johnson did? Because that's quite a different direction.
Be rounded.
As well.
Mine will be rounded. It'll have more spring, and more spring in the back, probably. V'd, quite narrow and V'd at the back, fuller at the front. It'll be very low freeboard. It'll be rounded on the top and the bottom, and there'll be a gap between the trampoline and the hull to let the wind blow straight through and reduce the windage.
Rounded at the top. Do you want to explain what you mean by that?
The middle of the boat will be about 350 circle section.
A circle. So yeah. a little hill to run over, or the tramp's going to be suspended?
The tramp's suspended. And the hull, if you cut the section across about the centreboard case, it'll be a circle or even possibly slightly flatter than a circle.
So
squashed vertical.
So you can now that you're not standing on the deck itself, you can probably build a hell of a lot lighter because it doesn't take any weight.
But you don't. It's the sheet of Dacron over the top that you walk on is lighter than trying to put strength under the deck.
Okay. What about the foredecks? You know, there's been a lot of talk on the Sailing Energy about different size foredecks. And
what do you want for at all?
Well, there's two different theories. One is obviously a smaller volume hull will maybe pull through after a crash.
Well, bow height, yeah. Bow height
and also the volume of the foredeck.
Yeah, bow height, I don't think. The find the foredecks in the water, you're in pretty much.
This is not G-rated, you can swear. You're in the shit.
And as moth sailors found out 20 years ago and catamaran sailors found out 30 years ago, the blunter you make something, the more sudden you stop. So if you've got a blunt foredeck that hits the water, you'll stop. I don't want a foredeck at all. The bow height will be reasonably generous, but it'll get shallower all the way down to the middle and then a bit deeper again at the back.
My take on it, not that anyone cares, when I first built virtual reality, I had no foredeck on it, and it just looked ugly. Foredecks are all about aesthetics. That's my take on it. Yes, they're probably lighter and you don't really need them, but I just don't like my boat without them.
Well, we'll go back to Chainsaw. Chainsaw, after it was resurrected, was built as a test to this current idea, and it might have got the proper one might have got built sooner, except I went off for 3 years experimenting with the canoes. So the chainsaw got resurrected. It still had the low freeboard it was built with originally, but the wings were elevated, the trampoline was suspended over the top, the mast was further forward and the centreboard was further forward than standard, the rig was unstayed so that the wings were further aft than they normally are. So the trampoline and the wing structure was smaller and lighter, and that was a plywood boat with aluminium wings, an unstayed mast, and everyone who picked it up said, gee, this is light. And it wasn't. It wasn't particularly light, but I'm sure I can build one a hell of a lot lighter with carbon wings and hull. Look out, 20 kilos.
So moving the rig forward and... What effect did that have, did you find? Is this something that you'll ask?
Yeah, the exciting part was that when you crash, there was no recovery because the mast hit the water front on. But if there were no stays, you didn't hit anything yourself. So, but I think that now we've learned a lot more about wand control and we don't crash anywhere near as much as we used to. And so I think that's worth a go again. Maybe not quite as far forward, but yeah.
With the unstayed rig, how'd you go with the leech tension?
Well, just the same as any other thing. You pull the bang on. But you've got to have a mast. The mast has to be stiffer. We put diamonds on the mast after a while as an experiment. It seemed to improve things. And the boat seemed to go okay. The foils weren't great. It was heavier than it should have been. The sail was about 10 years old. But it worked. I sold it to Eric at Balmoral and he's learning to sail it. But there was one day, one light day at St George, that Alan sailed it and he was getting up and foiling sooner than everybody else and nearly won the race. So it's a goer. It'll work.
There's one other boat in history that we haven't covered, and that's Tiger on a Chain. Yeah. So for someone who for so many years has built his own boats, what went through your mind to actually go and buy one?
Tiger on a Chain is a bit like the Johnny Cash song, where he steals components from the car factory over a 20-year period and ends up building the car at the end, and every bit of it is a different model. I bought various bits from Thorpe over a 5-year period, starting with, I think, a sail, a mast, a boom, and I made centreboard and rudder that looked like his, and I made wings that looked like his, and the hull was the only thing left. So having had a few frustrating seasons with homemade junk and still believing the Hungry Tiger was the best moth around and worthy of converting to foils, I got Thorpe to make me a hull, as good as all the other Hungry Tigers, but with a few more hard points to put the foils on. And I sailed it around for half a season without foils and had probably the best fun I'd ever had in a moth, because it was just so beautifully behaved compared with all the other monsters that I had. Everything worked properly, the buoyancy was in all the right places. Even converting it to foils has been fun too, even if I haven't got the foils to the same refinement that Thorpe had the Tiger design. So I don't regret doing it. I've still got it. I might sell it one day, but I want to experiment. I'll probably end up with an experimental boat and the Hungry Tiger at the same time.
Experimentation, I suppose, is the key word when it comes to you and your approach to things. Even though you got you purchased a, in air quotes, standard Hungry Tiger, it still wasn't standard. Like, you've had a rod through the foredeck, which was unheard of, at least in Australia at that time. I think it was the first boat in Australia to get that. And then you also implemented what is the now patented Stevo rudder.
Well, it's not patented. that's a mute point. But
that's another subject for another time.
That's not mine. That's Andrew's. Andrew's invention. Andrew built the first one. I built the second one. I showed Andrew McDougall my one at the Sunshine Nationals, and he thought, that's a good idea. I'll put that on my boat. And I didn't know my boat in that term was a fleet of blade riders. But that's what it turned out to be. McDougall and Blade Rider have paid the commission to Andrew by providing him with a sail, but the boat, the idea was not painted by either Blade Rider or by Andrew. But that, I think, has made a big difference. It's reduced the drag. It's added another, a much easier way of controlling and reducing it without increasing the drag. The next step is we're experimenting with some different foil shapes to go on the bottom of that, because we think that having lifting foil down there is not altogether the best way to go.
And what about the rod through the bow?
That just seemed logical. Apart from that, it saved $70 for the cable. By the way, I've just chopped that out, and I've put in one that's better alignment, so there'll be less friction, and it's a carbon tube instead of a bit of plastic conduit, so it saved a bit of weight too. Go back to some other things that we did. We talked about experimenting. There was an era, a period with, I think it must have been the chainsaw hull, where I went out one day with a rudder on the front and a rudder on the back, and no centreboard at all.
Yeah, I remember that day. I was next to you.
Luca was there. There were a few things not quite right. The fact that I had to hang over the back of the back wing to try and keep the bow out of the water. And again, this one wasn't the cable linkages between the two, but it was a push rod of a rigging wire inside some nylon hydraulic tube as a cable. For anyone who wants to try it, the thing to get rid of is the friction on the bearings in the front one, because what happened is that as soon as the bow started to lift, as soon as the bow foil started to lift the boat, the front steering bearing locked up, and whatever angle it was pointing, that's where you went, even if it was 45 degrees off the bow. And you followed it. But the boat did tack and jibe. It did get up and foil. It was very encouraging, and I think that's worth a try again one day when I work out how to make the systems work better. In principle, it makes sense. That's why there's a paint shop version of Luca on my web page with just that configuration.
We covered a lot of your projects, Phil, in this interview. What do you think the Motts will look like in 10 years' time?
The hull will be smaller and lighter and cheaper to build because it'll be simpler. The wings will be smaller and lighter because we don't move around as much as we used to. I think to reduce the cost of manufacture and shipment, because the M-class is going to become more and more commercial, it already has, and to compete with each other, they're trying to make cheap and cheaper boats. So I think the rig will become simpler. The mast will be two-piece, unstayed, eliminate all those components, and technically it's possible. We've done some experiments to show that it'll happen, that it's possible. But against the one design ideas coming from the manufacturers, the developers will go further if the rest of the class allows them. And inevitably, we'll have wing rigs because technology will allow us to build them lighter.
Sorry, when you say wing rigs, you're talking C-class.
C-class type wing rigs. We've got to work out how to make them strong and light and survivable.
I think that's a key point, isn't it? Survivable.
And so they won't look like a C-class wing rig with all that fragile structure inside a plastic bag. That's not viable. But the loads on a Moth are so small relative to most other boats that, and the area is quite small compared with most other boats. So I think other technologies will happen. We've proven already you can do cantilever Moth mast easily. I mean, Europe dinghies have been doing them for 40 years or something. We're not actually applying a hell of a lot more power to the boat, to the mast now than they are when they're sailing downwind in waves. OK dinghies and fins have been doing it for years. So the structure's not a problem. Ginger SeaTech told me when I was thinking about unstayed mast for my canoe, and I mentioned the OK dinghy one, he says, no, they're 3.5 kilos, but half of that's bog, because that's the rules. So the Moth mast doesn't have to weigh more than 2.5 kilos, which is perfectly viable when most stayed masts are only, you know, lucky to get under 2 kilos. So the structure inside a wing mast can be bigger diameter and lighter still. The volume of the wing mast isn't that great. If it was solid polystyrene, it would only weigh 10 kilos. And if you add up the weight, sail, batten, stays, spreaders, mast and boom, you get about 12 kilos anyway. So there's not much weight penalty involved. It's viable. I might do it in the next few years. We'll see.
So that's where you see the rigs going. With the foils, obviously, being an automatic focuser, I've always said that multiple sets of foils for different conditions are bound to happen sooner rather than later.
Yes.
How do you feel about it?
It definitely will happen. It won't happen. Everyone won't do it. But as soon as somebody wins a regatta with multiple foils, I see a problem to the class, because everyone who wants to win regatta then will have to have multiple sets of foils, and that'll put 10 or 15 grand under the price of a boat. And those that don't want to spend that money will disappear. So I've been lobbying for a long time to have one set of gear for a regatta, like most other classes.
I haven't
succeeded yet.
Yeah, I brought that up at the World Championships, AGM.
Yep.
But it seems like the class is a little bit reluctant at the moment.
Yeah.
I think, do you believe that's because it just hasn't happened yet, so maybe people just feel that it won't, or it's not an issue at the moment, so why worry about it?
And to be consistent, if we're going to have a ban on multiple foils, we have to have a ban on multiple rigs. So if I happen to bring my wing rig, I won't be able to use a soft sail as an alternative.
The one equipment rule that was in place for the 2005 Nationals at BlackRock, that specifically excluded rigs from the rule, so you could have as many rigs as you wanted.
That was that rule was in Australia only and was a result of my lobbying and enough support to bring it in for hulls and foils, and that was basically supported by the anti-foil lobby, who didn't want the foil sailors to be able to change in light and heavy weather.
Now, hang on, Phil. I see a loophole here. Didn't you have a foil where you could bolt the bottom on?
Mm-hmm. And I saw one race with the Nationals that year with the thing tied to the deck. It was off the bottom of the centreboard, but it was on the deck.
So can we now see moths coming with a little floating trailer behind them of all the equipment you want?
Yeah. But more likely you'll see a quiver of foils in the rubber ducky and zipping over between back-to-back races, swapping foils so that he has the best foils for the next race because the wind has changed. I think that would be bad for the class.
Yeah. I don't know when this is going to go away, but I'll mention anyway. I can always cut this out. I think the world and the lead-up into the worlds in Weymouth is going to be a proving point for that. So if you look at the number of, I remember Scott Babbage blogged about something like 4 boats, 14 masts, 11 sails. And then we had Simon Nelson talking on Sailing Anarchy about how it's been an arms race and he's seen like 5 different specs of CST narrow mast being tried. So I think particularly from a rig point of view, with the boats having the blade riders being out for more than a year now and no real change there, the area where people have been developing in the last 6 months at least has been with rigs. So it'll be interesting to see exactly how many sails and rig combinations people pull out at the world.
Big change in blade rider. They got the fiberglass one.
Well,
but they don't think the weight of the hull is important anymore.
Well, what's your thoughts on the blade rider effects? The blade rider's a production.
I don't care what they do as long as it's still a moth. I don't want the blade rider one design class. I'd like to have a million blade riders sailing in the moth class.
Thanks, Phil.
And that's it for this episode of Mothcast. Next time, we're going to sit down and have a chat with John Islett, Mr. Fastercraft.